Hi everyone, I just wanted to let you know that there will be two new episodes this week to mark the 60th anniversary of North by Northwest. So I hope that you enjoy my chat with Andy today, and also that you tune back in on Friday to hear me discuss Bernard Herrmann and his collaboration with Alfred Hitchcock. On that episode, I'm joined by Brandon Brown, who's currently making a documentary about a legendary composer. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again for this episode, in which I'm going to be talking about North by Northwest, Alfred Hitchcock's great film, of course, starring Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint, amongst others. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the podcast for the second time by Mr. Andy Wolverton. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Carl, and thank you so much for having me back on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. You know, I think we talked, when was it? It was back towards the beginning of the year somewhere, wasn't it, about Casablanca?
Yeah, I think that was back in January.
Yeah, so nice to get you back on. And I don't know, Andy, can you believe that North by Northwest has reached its 60th anniversary, if my mathematics serves me right?
It really is incredible. And I think one of the reasons is because it holds up so well today.
Yeah, well, we're going to discuss all of this, of course. But I just wanted to start with kind of your overall thoughts on Hitchcock, I suppose, because he's such a towering figure. Yeah, what are your overall thoughts on Hitchcock? Do you go along with the general consensus you hear about him?
He's an absolute master. I really don't think we can dispute that. And his influence has gone far, far beyond maybe even what he thought it might do. And he's probably my favorite director for pure entertainment value. But, you know, he could do so much more. I mean, he could thrill, he could terrify, he could create enormous levels of suspense. He just had the uncanny ability to tap into what caused audiences anxiety and really knew how to deliver it.
And how much do you think that's rooted in like the Hollywood studio system? Because, of course, he had this long career, you know, making films in England and then moving to Hollywood. And for me, I've always been a little fonder of the Hollywood era. And I mean, I've come across one or two people over the years who prefer the early films, the kind of Lady Vanishes or the 39 Steps or whatnot. But what do you think?
Well, I really enjoy those too, and I have to confess I've seen very few of his silent pictures.
Yep.
So most of what I've seen is the later British films and the American films as well. And you know, there's several that I need to revisit. In fact, one of my goals for 2020 is to try to see every Hitchcock film and write about them.
I like that you've already set yourself some goals for next year. I'm impressed. That's good.
It may be too lofty. We'll see.
We'll see. So tell us about, I mean, last time we spoke, people who listened to the Casablanca episode will remember, we spoke about the film club you do at the library you work at. So how has Hitchcock kind of factored into that? Which of his films have you screened at the library?
We've actually screened in 4 years. We've screened three Hitchcock films. We did. I think the first one we did was Shadow of a Doubt, mm-hmm. and then we did Rear Window about midway last year, and maybe back in April we did Notorious. So we've only done three in 4 years. We get a lot of requests from. Yeah. The audience is to do more Hitchcock, but I don't want to overload it with Hitchcock. I mean, I could do a Hitchcock film every month and be very content, but I kind of want to strategically plan those.
So what's your sense about what the people who come along sort of think and feel about Hitchcock and his films? Because I guess you've got Shadow of a Doubt, maybe a slightly more, not obscure, but doesn't perhaps have the same name recognition as something like Rear Window. So yeah, how have audiences responded to those films you just mentioned?
Rear Window, definitely most everyone that came had seen before, and many had seen Notorious before,
yeah.
But very few had seen Shadow of a Doubt. And I think it's kind of one of those forgotten Hitchcock films, but I think it's getting more play now. It played at Noir City Film Noir Festival last, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, and that got people more interested in it. So I'm hoping that it will gain some traction and become one of the go-to Hitchcock films for fans.
Okay, and something like North by Northwest, you'd be hoping to screen at some point, I suppose. I just imagine that would be a great one to see with a big audience. I've never seen it on the big screen, but I think it would play really well in that kind of setting.
I do want to do that. I will have to do, because the running time is a little bit long, we have some problems with running time and when we can show our films and the earliest we can show them so people will have enough time for supper and things like that. But yeah. I think maybe that's going to be a good Saturday afternoon movie sometime next year.
Okay. And before we move on to North by Northwest, I mean, aside from that film, is there a Hitchcock film you could single out as a particular favorite?
Well, for years, I used to say that Vertigo was my favorite, and I still love it. And I think maybe I've seen it, maybe I've overdosed on Vertigo just a little bit. I've seen it so many times. But I really do love Shadow of a Doubt. But I think my favorite as far as sheer rewatchability is probably Rear Window.
I find it hard to dispute that. I think Rear Window's tremendous. It's interesting you say about overdosing on Vertigo, because I think the thing with Vertigo for so long was that it was kind of hard to see, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, and now it's as firmly established as, I think it was top, wasn't it, of the Sight and Sound greatest films of all time poll in 2012 and stuff like that. It's just the consensus around it has solidified, isn't it?
It is, and I'm kind of disturbed by the number of people who get online and they talk about all of the inaccuracies and inconsistencies in Vertigo, which I recognize there's so many things in there that couldn't happen or shouldn't happen, but I still love it. It's a very personal film to me, and Jimmy Stewart is one of my favorite actors of all time. I just love the film, and the Bernard Herrmann score is just tremendous. And I know we'll talk more about him later today.
Yeah, and are you talking about sort of like the plot logic? Is that the kind of thing you've seen people kind of take issue with? Because I think that perhaps applies to North by Northwest too, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, it probably does too.
So yeah, we're going to talk about North by Northwest. So if anyone listening hasn't seen it yet, please, please, please consider doing so. I think you're very unlikely to be disappointed. But in a nutshell, I suppose, it's a film about a guy called Roger Thornhill, played by Cary Grant. He's an ad executive who gets mistaken for someone called George Kaplan, who turns out not to exist in the end. And Thornhill gets embroiled in it. You know, it's this cross-country adventure involving trains, double crosses, microfilm. I don't want to say too much. If you haven't seen it yet, you know, I've got no issues if you stop the podcast, watch it, and then come back. But it's interesting, Andy, I think that one of the things I had been having a look at this week is there's a copy of the screenplay in my local library in which Ernest Lehman, who wrote the screenplay, discusses the process by which he came to write the film. And I think, you know, Bernard Herrmann had brought him and Hitchcock together for lunch during the film in the Rear Window. And then they went back and forth. Hitchcock wanted to do an adaptation of The Wreck of the Mary Deer. Eventually, they decided it wouldn't go ahead, but Hitchcock got on quite well with Lehman, it seems. So, you know, let's do something else kind of thing. And they started throwing ideas around. And one day, Ernest Lehman said, "All I want to do is write the Hitchcock picture to end all Hitchcock pictures." So, Andy Wolverton, did he succeed? Is North by Northwest the Hitchcock film to end all Hitchcock films?
You know, that's a tall order, but you look at it and you think, everything that is involved in all of Hitchcock, the suspense, the tension, the anxiety, the comedy, there's so many other things that are a part of it. I think that maybe it is. Maybe it is the quintessential Hitchcock film.
Yeah, well, Francois Truffaut, in his conversation with Hitchcock that formed the basis of the Hitchcock-Truffaut book, he suggests that North by Northwest is the picture that epitomizes the whole of Hitchcock's work in America. And to be fair to Lehman, he does define it further in that introduction I was quoting from there. So he sort of says he wanted to do something with wit and glamour, sophistication, suspense, many different colourful locales, a real movie. As he tells it, so he wrote this introduction in 1999, but as he recounts it, that quote led Hitchcock to say, "Oh, I always wanted to do a chase scene across Mount Rushmore." Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of lines up pretty well with what you said, actually. So I guess what it means is, if we were kind of categorizing Hitchcock films, you'd probably place North by Northwest closer to things like The 39 Steps or Saboteur or The Man Who Knew Too Much than we would to something like Vertigo or Marnie. Do you think that's fair? Is that how you see it too?
I think that's very fair, because in films like Vertigo and Marnie, we see more of an obsession, the theme of obsession, and some really, really dark things going on. And although North by Northwest is definitely lighter and it has a comedic element and it does have a romantic element, those things are basically a part of a film that really never slows down. North by Northwest just starts off from the moment Cary Grant steps out of that elevator in the office building until the very last scene. It just never stops. And you could say that about other Hitchcock films as well, but I think there are moments of really dark reflection in Vertigo and Marnie and some of his other films that you don't really get with North by Northwest.
Yeah, and I think that maybe raises an interesting line of discussion, you know, kind of about the importance of this film in Hitchcock's body of work, really. So there's a moment in the film where Thornhill, he's got this matchbook with his initials, R-O-T, on it. And Eve Kendall, played by Eva Marie Saint, she asks him what the O stands for in Roger O. Thornhill. And he says, nothing. And it made me wonder, is there a hole at the center of this film as well as at the center of the name of the protagonist? Because one of the books I've been looking at, it's a really good Hitchcock book. I think you may have, I might have seen you tweet a picture of this book, actually. Robin Wood's book, Hitchcock's Films Revisited. Is that one you've seen?
It is. It's a very, very good book.
Yeah, it is very good. And he sort of says, he says North by Northwest is a masterpiece. He doesn't dispute that, but he also says that beside its immediate neighbors, it's a lightweight work, a relaxation in which we see Hitchcock working at something less than full pressure. So yeah, it does come at a fascinating point in Hitchcock's career, doesn't it? Just after Vertigo, just before Psycho. So yeah, it sounds like maybe you agree with Wood. Is this a less substantial film than something like Vertigo or Psycho? And if so, if this is just a consummate example of Hitchcock as a light entertainer, does it really matter?
I think it does, because it, like you said, it comes at a very interesting time between Vertigo and Psycho. And it may seem like it is a lighter piece of entertainment. You could also compare it to something that came much later that I grew up with, like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. You could say, well, that's just light entertainment, but it's done so well. And you get to see, even in something light like that, and North by Northwest too, you get to see a lot of great characterization. I think what we see with Thornhill is very, very interesting in that we see a man that is pretty much running on all cylinders from the beginning. He's taking charge of everything. He's rattling off orders to his secretary. He's a brash, overconfident, really an inconsiderate person. And I mean, what other profession would he be in besides advertising? And as the movie progresses, all of these strengths are taken away from him. And we really see that he's a pretty shallow character. But, you know, and that's where things really get interesting, where all of his strengths are taken away from him. And it's almost like chance, fate, bad luck have conspired against him. And now he's trapped. And the thing about the film that I think works so well is that we've all felt like they were in that situation. And overall, that's one thing Hitchcock does so well. He takes the average person and whether it's the wrong man story or a mistaken identity story, we have all been in that situation, but he takes somebody that is so confident and so with it and just takes all those things away. And then we're there with him. And we were thinking, what would we do? What if this were happening to me? So I think that's one of the strengths of the film, that even though it may be a lighter film, has got a lot of depth to it.
I would agree. I think it's undoubtedly a masterful slice of entertainment just on the surface. I think it's riveting, so much tension, great performances, some very memorable individual sequences, which I think we'll talk about, some humorous moments. But yeah, I would argue, I think there's a bit more of a meets the eye here too. I think that occasionally there's this kind of nightmarish quality to some of the events that sort of seeps in, even though I think the overall effect of the film is essentially that it's an adrenaline rush, you know. And yeah, I agree with what you say about Thornhill. You know, because there are things in that early section of the film, you know, he kind of steals the cab from that guy who was ahead of him in the line and stuff like that. And some of the other things you talk about, like, you know, he's brash and, you know, overly confident and stuff like that. And I think some of these traits could be very off-putting if they were coming from another actor, but is it because it's Cary Grant that we're kind of taken in by it too? Do you think he's got the right qualities that allows us to kind of not be repelled by this guy in the very early scenes?
I think he definitely does, because and Hitchcock fans, this was his fourth film for Hitchcock. Yep. And so people that were keeping up with this knew that he'd appeared in Suspicion, Notorious, and To Catch a Thief. And they were very comfortable. And apparently Grant was quite comfortable with working with Hitchcock. We tend to forget that Cary Grant was 54 at the time, and he only made six films after this. So this is pretty close to the end of his film career. But he certainly looks and feels comfortable in the role of Roger Thornhill, like this wasn't a big step for him. And maybe it's because we want to see this brash Madison Avenue guy get taken down a few pegs. But once he does, we want him to win as well.
He's so good, I think, because, like I say, you've got such a slick operator as Thornhill. And I think it's Grant's star quality that quickly draws you into his orbit. So, yeah, I think we're thinking, I like Cary Grant, or perhaps we're thinking, I wish I could be like Cary Grant, you know. So it's highly effective, I think, when Hitchcock kind of pulls the rug out from underneath him. Mm. And I think that's part of what generates this sort of nightmarish quality that I sort of see in the film. But there's kind of a romantic element to this too, isn't there, in the sense that he's drawn into this kind of exciting adventure. You know, you can sort of see the appeal of being mistaken for a spy, of being, you know, ending up in a train car with Eva Marie Saint, and ultimately, of course, being the person who saves her and saves the day. So you sort of see the way he moves, don't you? He goes from being quite distressed by the situation at the outset, and he sort of moves to kind of playing along with it in order to make some headway. Mm-hmm. And again, I think Grant's just the perfect leading man for that kind of thing too, isn't he? I mean, he's utterly credible in the love stuff, the love scenes. And I think he suggests the more positive, virtuous qualities of Thornhill quite convincingly too, I would say. What do you reckon? Do you ever feel like there's a disconnect between the character we meet in the first couple of scenes and how he sort of develops, or how he acts as the story develops?
That's very interesting, because one of the things that, like you mentioned, he seems very comfortable around women.
Yeah.
Especially around attractive women. And he even says in the car scene in the dining car, he has to check this desire that he always wants to make love to beautiful women. Yeah. I mean, he's just saying that to her right in front, and he doesn't think that she knows who he is. But so you can tell he's using some of those advertising executive skills to work with the ladies. So it seems very, very comfortable for him. And perhaps he's in such danger that he goes back to that as a kind of a, here's something that I really know how to do. So yeah, maybe I can use those skills to get me out of this trouble and, you know, maybe land in this lady's compartment at the same time. But yeah, it's really, and that's one of the great scenes in the film. It's so comedic, and we want him to be able to get away from danger.
Yeah.
But Eva Marie Saint is so sexy in that scene. And we can talk more about the innuendos that are going on there. But yeah, that really does – it is kind of a turning point for Roger Thornhill once he meets Eve Kendall.
Yeah, because before that – and again, Robin Wood discusses this in the book. He says, the film's first movement is devoted to a systematic stripping away of all the protective armor of modern city man on which Thornhill relies. So yeah, this guy is really comfortable in and amongst crowds – suddenly becomes very isolated. I think his drinking habit is referred to in early dialogue, and is kind of weaponized against him, isn't it? So there's that great scene, I've always adored it, where they get him drunk and put him behind the wheel of the car. Like you kind of alluded to, his fondness for beautiful women. So you get the sense that there's this kind of, his personal identity is being stripped away. It's kind of collapsing in on itself with all this confusion about the names and so on. But I guess the thing is, it's done with quite a lightness of touch, isn't it? That I don't think we ever get to the stage where we feel like we're uncomfortable because we're watching this modern man's existential crisis or anything like that. You know, I guess that's because of Hitchcock's kind of deftness, and maybe to do with the way that, you know, how sturdy the screenplay is too.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's one of the masterful touches of Ernest Lehman that was able to write that in there to keep it from getting too heavy and too dark. But, you know, it's funny because even that scene we were talking about where they get Thornhill drunk, and they have him in the room, and they're pouring the bourbon,
yeah.
and it just keeps pouring and pouring and pouring, and it gets to the point where you don't know whether this you should laugh at this or whether this is really scary, because if you drank that much bourbon, you would be done. And the really funny thing to me is the scene moves so quickly, and I keep thinking, you know, if Thornhill had been killed after an incident of drunk driving, based on his past, nobody would have questioned it at all.
Yeah. And it's just an incredible way to try and kill somebody, isn't it? It's like, there must be a million ways to do it more easily. Yeah, let's talk about the Hitchcock blonde then. And, you know, maybe some other familiar Hitchcock themes and motifs. Because you already mentioned, and we've both already mentioned Eva Marie Saint as Eve Kendall. So, yeah, how would you summarize her? She's kind of a Mata Hari-esque figure, isn't she? And I'll tell you, the thing I always forget is how late into the film it is before she first appears. I think it's a good 45 minutes or so before we actually see her on screen, isn't it?
It is quite late. And the thing that's interesting to me, and I can't remember where I ran across this, but I ran across Hitchcock's directions to Eva Marie Saint for the role.
Yeah.
And he told her three things: lower your voice, don't use your hands, and always look directly into Cary Grant's eyes, which was probably not a very difficult thing to do. But I get the sense that Hitchcock made her feel more comfortable on the set than maybe he did with other leading ladies. And, you know, there are many, many stories, as you know, about mm-hmm. Hitchcock being obsessed with blondes. But it seems like from all that I've read, she had a very good experience on this film and never felt like he was obsessing over her as a person, but really just let her do the role by herself.
And I think she's very good at kind of suggesting the hidden depths to the character before the screenplay kind of clarifies that to us. Do you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. you know, after Grant's character feels betrayed and everything, I think we're sort of a step ahead of him, if that makes sense.
And yes, I think so too. And we don't really know at the beginning when we first see her. And I think it's really interesting. Lately I've become fascinated with Hitchcock and the wardrobe choices that he makes. And when we first see her, of course, she's wearing the suit. And then when they're in the compartment, she's wearing white, which would suggest purity. Mm-hmm. And we would think, okay, here's someone that he can trust. She even insists on him sleeping on the floor and not in the bed with her. So we think, oh, wow, this is a really pure, good woman, good girl. But then later when she appears after the deception, when she's wearing the black dress with the red flowers, which is one of my favorite dresses in all of cinema. It's just wonderful. You know, it's got the black suggests that there's a darkness in her, and the red even suggests that, you know, maybe blood is going to be shed or there's intense danger in there. So we do get two very different looks at her, and we begin to wonder, What is she all about? Is she a femme fatale? Is she on the right side? Lots of questions that get answered later, but when we see it for the first time, we're not sure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's good to hear what you said a little earlier that, you know, she, the actress, had a positive experience on the film. So what about the sort of the Hitchcock blonde treatment of the character then? So let me read you a quote from a book I've quoted on other episodes of the podcast, I think, which is Molly Haskell's From Reverence to Rape. And she talks about the Hitchcock blonde and how he treats these figures. And she says, "The blonde is reprehensible not because of what she does, but because of what she withholds. Love, sex, trust. She must be punished, her complacency shattered, and so he submits his heroines to excruciating ordeals. The plot itself becomes a mechanism for destroying their icy self-possession, their emotional detachment." So, yeah, do you see any of that, or do you see anything about the way the character is developed or utilized that makes you uncomfortable or not in this instance?
You know, I was thinking as you were reading that, how the similarities and differences between another Hitchcock heroine in a different situation is Ingrid Bergman as Ilsa in Notorious,
yes.
who is also playing a spy. And although there are some similar characteristics, it's interesting how Eve Kendall is actually doing a double deception mm-hmm. because she's having to deceive Roger Thornhill while she's attempting to deceive Philip Van Damme. So it's a really, she does a really fine balancing act of trying to keep both of those deceptions going at the same time, which I think is really tremendous. I don't know of another Hitchcock heroine that quite has that role that has to do the double deception like she does here.
And in some of those scenes, though, so like after Grant feels double-crossed and all that, there's a bit of cruelty in the way sort of he speaks about her, and a real bitterness to it that I think perhaps lines up a little with what Haskell says. So, you know, he spits out all these lines about, I think he calls her a treacherous little tramp or something. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to point out that that's probably when Roger Thornhill probably seems the least sympathetic to us as the audience too, or at least that's how it seemed to me. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes. He, and especially we see that in the auction scene just before he, does his thing. He says something about, he's really at his most disrespectful there, which is really ironic because they're in an atmosphere where you're supposed to be respectful. Mm-hmm. The events establish rules, but he calls her a statue. He says, "You have no feelings to hurt." And what's interesting about the way Hitchcock stages this is he's standing behind her.
Yes, that's it.
And Eve is actually in tears, but Thornhill can't see it. It's almost her way of apologizing to him, but he literally can't see it because of where he's standing. Yeah, and it's a tremendous emotional things are going on there, and it's really a wonderful scene, again, surrounded by these people that are supposed to be behaving in a very respectful manner.
I mean, I think Eva Marie Saint, a beautiful, beautiful woman. I mean, is there a sense that the film, maybe the standard gender roles are a little more subtle than you might think at first glance? Because I think she's beautiful, she's presented as such. I also think that Cary Grant's character is sexualized to some degree too, because you remember that moment, it always seems kind of odd to me, but it's where he goes through the woman's bedroom when he...
I love that.
Yeah, when he escapes from the other room and the woman puts the glasses on and asks him to stop and stuff like that. I think Eve also talks about how nice his face is, and I think he appears without his shirt on at one point too. So yeah, do you know what? Did you pick up on that too?
I did. In fact, I was having a conversation with a woman who's a big fan of the film.
Yeah.
And we got to that point about, him going through the hospital room and the woman that says stop. And she says, "Doesn't he look hot with his shirt off?" And I'm like, "He's in his 50s. And she says, "Yeah, but he still looks great." And he does. He still has that sex appeal. And I think he had it right up until his last film. I mean, he just looked great. It was definitely there. We didn't obviously know Eva Marie Saint as well at that point as we knew Cary Grant, mm-hmm. but she definitely has a very strong appeal. I think she has one of the most distinctive voices in the movies, and I think her voice is just so sexy. I could just listen to her talk. And of course, she's still with us, and from frequently she does events, and the voice is still wonderful.
Just one more thing on Eve and Thornhill. So there's that final scene on the bunk bed, isn't there? And I think when I talked about Shadow of a Doubt on the podcast previously, I talked a little bit there about the importance of the bed scenes in that film, because they kind of suggest a parallel between the two Charlies. And, that end scene here where Heath hauls her up to the top bunk and they're now married and so on. And it's followed by what Hitchcock himself describes as the phallic shot of the train entering the tunnel. So, yeah, I don't know about you, but I enjoy kind of the naughtiness of that moment, I suppose.
I think it's absolutely hilarious. And that's the one thing that I really want to show at the library, just so we can get to that last scene and see how many people get it. It's great.
I'm curious too. Yeah. How many modern audiences pick up on it, and also how many audience members at the time would have been kind of clued into that. I'm not quite sure.
I don't know either.
So which other Hitchcock themes or motifs that are familiar from his other films, did you pick up on any others that you thought were worthy of mention here?
Well, the wrong man is a typical theme with Hitchcock, a mistaken identity. We see that in many, many films. And, we talked earlier about the espionage element in The 39 Steps and Notorious and other films. And, of course, you have the mysterious, dangerous woman, the femme fatale, that occurs from time to time. And of course, the Hitchcock MacGuffin, which is in many, many films. And in this case, it's the microfilm mm-hmm. hidden inside the figure. So there are a lot of familiar Hitchcock themes and motifs going on in North by Northwest that I know that fans then and now appreciate seeing. So those are always fun.
Yeah, and maybe we should pick up a little more on this idea of the MacGuffin. So I feel like a lot of people know these days what a MacGuffin is, but maybe not everybody does. So these are the items, aren't they, in Hitchcock films especially, that are of great importance to the characters, but of lesser importance to Hitchcock and by extension the viewer. So yeah, we have this microfilm containing government secrets or whatnot. Does it serve too? I mean, you've got this idea that the nature of the MacGuffin is kind of unimportant. So in North by Northwest, you've got a plot that otherwise is somewhat political, haven't you? You know, this kind of Cold War backdrop to it. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, the events of the film could be, you know, another filmmaker could do this in a highly political way. But I don't think it really feels like that here. Not in the way that something like Casablanca, which we discussed previously, does. Do you know what I mean? I feel like those elements are quite sort of held back, if that makes sense.
Right. And I wonder if all of that is because Hitchcock didn't want to get involved in the politics of the moment. And even though this is a Cold War film in the Cold War era, he doesn't get bogged down in the details. And you can say the same thing for Notorious, yeah. Even though this is post-World War II, very, very soon on the heels after World War II. It gives these films a little bit of an element of timelessness, even though they are set in certain periods. You know, we're not bogged down in the details. We aren't really bogged down into the, you know, mm-hmm. all of the things happening during the Cold War, or, you know, and I think that helps the films hold up better. We can look at them and say, oh, yeah, we recognize, even if someone in their 20s were to watch or younger were to watch North by Northwest, they don't need to know the details of the Cold War. They don't need to know Nikita Khrushchev. They don't need to know the Bay of Pigs. All they need to know is there's microfilm here. And yeah. This could change the balance of the Cold War.
Yeah, I think there are a few interesting things to note on the sort of Cold War context, but I agree with what you say, that the film does maintain a more timeless quality because of the way Hitchcock deals with it. But Thornhill emerges as somewhat cynical, I think, doesn't he? At one point, he says to the professor, perhaps you ought to start losing a few Cold Wars, mm-hmm. you know, because if you're exploiting people like in the way that you're exploiting Eve. So, you know, there aren't really any patriotic tub-thumping moments in this film, I don't think. He's quite critical of the CIA. And there's that scene, isn't there, where we're kind of privy to them talking. You know, it's about a third of the way through, I think, mm-hmm. you know. And they talk about, are we being callous? And they decide, or the professor decides that they're not. But I don't know. I don't think they really seem to put themselves through the ethical ringer, you know. I mean, in the end, it works out well enough for everybody, doesn't it? You know, Thornhill rescues Eve. The professor helps them do so, and Van Damme's plan is ultimately thwarted. But yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think it goes into enough detail to make us think that, you know, they aren't some faceless people out yeah. in the distance, that they're, you know, they're really concerned about this as well, although their considerations are far different, perhaps, than Rogers and Eve Kendall. But yeah, it does give it an element of humanity, so that we know that they're, you know, these do really represent real people, even though they are a larger set like the CIA or whatever the organization is.
So one of the characters I really enjoy seeing here is the character of Leonard, who's played by Martin Landau, because I've always really liked Martin Landau as an actor. You know, he had this great kind of late in life renaissance too, didn't he? Where mm-hmm. he was doing things like he was working for Francis Ford Coppola, for Woody Allen, and for Tim Burton. But it's great to see him in an earlier role here. And many commentators, I think, over the years have pointed out there's kind of an implicit homosexuality to his character. And I think there are other Hitchcock films too where there are veiled homosexual references. So yeah, do you see that? Did you pick up on that from him?
I remember the first time I saw this, and I thought, and I probably saw it when I was maybe 18 or 19, and it was that line where he says, call it my female intuition or women's intuition. And I remember even thinking back then, that's an odd thing for a man to say. I'd never heard a man say that. And the way that he acts when he fires the blank, and then the way that Philip Van Damme reacts with him by punching him in the jaw, you know, it struck me even then. I thought, these guys must be lovers. you know, for them to act that way. The jealousy, and Van Damme even says, "I'm really touched. You're jealous."
And that's the implication, isn't it? I think his hostility to Eve is motivated by that. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Landau? Are you a fan of his too?
Oh, yes, very, very much so. I watched him briefly when I was growing up on Space 1999.
Yeah.
And that was probably the first exposure I had to him. Or maybe I saw him on a couple of episodes of Mission Impossible as this, you know, ultra cool guy that could do all of these things. And then it was much later that I saw him in North by Northwest. But yeah, he's such a striking presence on screen. He's so tall, and in North by Northwest, he's so lanky. And there's something about him, even in the library scene, just before he pours the bourbon down Roger Thornhill's throat, that he just looks menacing. And there's something about the way he, you know, the scene where he's holding the bottle in one hand and he's holding the glass in the other, and he's holding them so far apart, and it seems like a friendly gesture on the one hand, like, you know, let's have a libation before you depart. But there's something in his eyes that's so sinister. And I think he did that really, really well. But he was able to – he had such a wide range in his career. But this I think this is one of the films that people remember him for, even if they've seen everything like Ed Wood and all the television work he did. It's a really striking performance.
So, I mean, earlier – I said occasionally there's this slight nightmarish aspect to the film, especially to the central scenario, I think. And there's another example I wanted to point to as well, which is the scene in the lift or the elevator, I think you guys would say.
Yeah, right.
Where Thornhill's mother says, you know, they're followed in by those two heavies. And she says, "You two gentlemen aren't really trying to kill my son, are you?" And, you know, everybody starts laughing. Kind of an interesting thing to have your own mother chuckling away at the thought of her son being killed. One thing I'd forgotten is because Eve doesn't appear for so long in the film, that first section, there is this kind of fun double act, isn't there, between Thornhill and his mother, played by Jesse Royce Landis. And she's a very skilled performer too.
She is. And I was stunned to learn that she was only 1 year older than Cary Grant when they filming this. So, and you know, that would have, you could almost to make a TV series out of his relationship with his mother. I mean, it's such a strange relationship. And, you know, she's always, he says that she's always smelling his breath like a bloodhound to see if I've been drinking. And I absolutely love the scene where he asks her to go to the hotel. Was it? Yes. Go up to the hotel room.
Yeah.
And he holds out $10 and she says, "I wouldn't do it. I can't believe you had asked me to." And he says, "How about 15? And she snatches it up and goes.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, everybody talks about mothers in Hitchcock and how they're kind of overbearing and so on. And I guess she kind of fits that dynamic too. But the important thing to stress is the fact that it has this comic effect here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so they aren't uniformly presented the same way, even if, you know, the mother figure is always an important aspect. So what do you think about Mason then? So we haven't really talked much about James Mason, and, you know, he obviously, Philip Van Damme, he's the main villain of the piece, really, and he's a very effective performer in this kind of role too, even if he doesn't perhaps get that much to do, but what he does get, he does extremely well.
He does. And I actually see Philip Van Damme as sort of another type of Roger Thornhill. He's also kind of condescending. You know, he's also tasteful. He's elegant. He's cultured. He's smooth. He's sophisticated. And I love the scene where he and Thornhill meet for the first time in the library. And it's almost choreographed. It's almost like a dance. They're checking each other out and they're circling around the room. And it's almost like they're checking for weaknesses. But Van Damme, and you can see what I love about the character and how Mason plays this. You can see when Eve Kendall talks about, "When I met Van Damme, I saw nothing but his charm." And you can see that even in that first scene, that he is charming, but he is so biting and is so, I mean, everything coming out of his mouth is like a knife to Thornhill. Mm. And it's a wonderful little cat and mouse game that they're playing with each other. And I love Mason. In fact, I watched another movie with Mason last night, which wasn't as good, called The Macintosh Man. with Paul Newman. And an interesting movie, but I didn't think it quite worked. But Mason is always good. And it's not just the voice, although the voice is very distinctive, but he was perfect for this role. I really can't imagine anyone else. And I don't think Hitchcock ever used him again, did he?
No, I don't believe so. No. And I really like that scene you referred to in the, you know, the kind of dance you spoke of, because there's that moment, isn't there, where he says something about if you do what I say, you'll have a reasonable chance of surviving the evening. Mm-hmm. And you sort of see how that changes Thornhill's, you know, he starts to realize, hang on.
Yeah.
I'm in something really serious right here.
This is big stuff.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So I wanted to talk about some of the individual great set pieces, I think. So the one that first comes to mind for me, I don't know about you, but whenever I think about North by Northwest, the first sequence I think of is the crop duster sequence, which is just phenomenal. And I think when we talked about Casablanca, we discussed how many of the scenes in that film, or many of the moments, function extremely well in isolation. You know, you see them on a clip show or something, and even without the wider context, you're still kind of drawn into them. So do you think the same kind of thing maybe applies to that sequence?
I think it does, because I think it's such a brilliant scene on its own, but I think where it comes in the film is very important. That scene happens at almost the film's midpoint. And at that point, we know that Eve has deceived Roger, but he doesn't know it. And also, for the most part, before that moment, he has always been inside places. He's been inside buildings. He's been inside cars, bars, taxi cabs. And now he's outside, and there are no walls, no roof. It's just open country. And it's a real shock to the system for us to see that. And he's really just completely out there, isolated. And what's interesting is he's trying to escape, and while he's trying to escape, he has this bus barreling down the road after the crop dusting scene, and the bus is filled with people. And I always thought it was interesting that he's got all these people, and by extension, this is civilization that's about to kill him. You know, even though he's by himself, there's all these people that are coming down and are just as dangerous as the crop duster. But it's really interesting too that Bernard Herrmann uses no music here. And I mean, it's just, there's a little bit of dialogue between Roger and the man that's waiting on the car across the street. But I think that just creates so much more tension having no music.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I just think it's great. I've never tired of watching that. I think I have watched that scene in isolation before. I can't quite remember why. Well, what's funny is I don't think it loses anything with repeat viewing, because you can kind of imagine that it might, that maybe it's the element of surprise that works and that is kind of integral to the effect. But no, I think it's so well constructed and it's drawn out. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I think it's extended in just the right ways, you know, but it works a treat even like the 20th time you see it, you know. And there was an interesting quote I came across from, I think it's in that Ernest Lehman introduction to the screenplay I referred to earlier. So Hitchcock apparently said to him, "I always wanted to do a scene where our hero is standing all alone in a wide open space and there's nobody and nothing else in sight for 360 degrees around as far as the eye can see. And then along comes a tornado, no place to run." And Lehman kind of said, you know, how can the bad guys manufacture a tornado? And ultimately they talked it out and it became the crop duster sequence.
Yeah.
You know, so I think of it as, is it too pretentious to call it like pure cinema?
Well, no, I think it's okay. And you know, one of the things that I have trouble with at the library all the time is introducing older films to younger audiences, and they'll see something like the, you know, rear projection, or, you know, like you have in that scene, and they will say, "That looks so fake. How can you not laugh at that?" And I always tell them that at the time, yeah, everybody knew that was fake, but they believed it. We just accepted it. But when you watch that crop dusting scene, your hands are gripping the seats. I mean, even though you know logically that what you're seeing is manufactured, that anxiety and that suspense is real.
Also, what Truffaut says to Hitchcock in that interview is, he says, "The most appealing aspect," and I think this lines up with what you're saying about younger audiences too, "the most appealing aspect of that sequence with the plane is that it's totally gratuitous. It's a scene that's been drained of all plausibility or even significance. Cinema approaching this way becomes a truly abstract art like music. And I think Truffaut also points out that Hitchcock was even criticized by some people at the time for that sort of gratuitousness he refers to.
Mm.
So even back then, I think some people felt he was a bit too cavalier with logic, or sometimes that he produced these fantastical situations in his films and then didn't do sufficiently interesting things with them. So I know I've got a book of film criticism by the novelist Graham Greene, who was never a Hitchcock fan.
Mm.
And this was always the kind of thing he used to point out too. But here it's kind of the absence of the logic that's the real strength of the sequence, you know. The film draws attention to it, doesn't it? That guy who turns up, he says, oh, that's funny. There are no crops to be dusted, right. You know. So I think most viewers would understand on some level, and this will be interesting if you ever do screen the film to kind of to ask them about this, you know. I think most viewers would understand on some level that Hitchcock and Ernest Lehman completely understand what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what about the scene at the United Nations? Because I really like that too. And I think it goes back to some of these things we've kind of alluded to about chaos and stability and so on. Because if the UN represents anything, I mean, especially back in 59, I guess, it's stability and order. So, again, to kind of stage a murder scene there is an act that's very dramatically effective. And I also love that moment where you kind of get the God's eye view shot, don't you,
mm-hmm.
of Thornhill running away. So a great way to kind of visually suggest just how helpless he's now become.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the UN is a place of potential world order and, you know, things progressing in a way to benefit everyone. And then Thornhill's life is completely off the rails when he gets there. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that scene, the bird's eye view, because when I don't know if they did this in the UK, but a couple of years ago, they released this as part of a TCM big screen classics series in local theaters.
No, I don't think we get those, no.
Oh, and it was wonderful. It's the only time I've seen this on the big screen, but it really brought out the contrast between these enormous structures and the ant-sized characters. And one of those is obviously at the Mount Rushmore scene, but also these shots at the UN where Thornhill is just literally dwarfed by these imposing structures, and he comes across as little more than an ant. Yeah, that's a tremendous moment. And of course, the famous story that the UN would not allow Hitchcock to shoot there, but he did it anyway.
Yeah, they got some kind of shot on the run, didn't they?
Right, from across the street there or something.
Yeah. So, what about the Mount Rushmore sequence that closes out the film then?
Yeah.
Because what's kind of interesting is that what I've read, and I don't know if what you've read kind of backs this up too, but there was actually a bit more of a provisional aspect to the screenplay than we might imagine. So it feels to me like a fantastically constructed screenplay. But there were some aspects that kind of clicked in kind of late in the day and so on. But I don't think it ever feels that way, does it? So, yeah, what do you think of that? And what did you think of the Mount Rushmore kind of ending?
It's really tremendous that it works as well as it does, because it is, of course, the Department of Interior would not allow them to shoot on Mount Rushmore. Not so much for safety reasons, but because they just didn't think it was a proper thing to do. But Hitchcock had this set constructed that, and if you watch the extras on the DVD or Blu-ray commentary, I kind of wish I hadn't seen it, because now I know how they did it. And that Eva Marie Saint was in absolutely no danger at all when it looks like she's, you know, about to fall to her death. But, you know, considering the miniatures and the sets, it really is pretty amazing. And again, this is one of those scenes where modern audiences would look at and, you know, maybe scoff at it, but it's believable enough then and now for us to say, wow, these, you know, they really are doing this, even though we know they're not, but it's, we buy into it.
Yeah, I think when I watch that, you know, it still quickens my pulse and all that stuff. You know, I think it still works really well. I mean, we had a listener comment in that he didn't directly mention the Mount Rushmore sequence, but I think we can kind of touch on this here. So from Sean, he describes North by Northwest as his favorite Hitchcock and his favorite action thriller. Casting perfect with iconic locations. Rotten Tomatoes score 99% critics and 94% from the audience. Everyone loves it. Very influential also. Just ask James Bond. So, yeah, what's your sense on the influence of this film? Because when I see North by Northwest, I think, yeah, you can see the DNA in some of the Bond films. But even more modern stuff, you know, I think, whether it's intentional or not, but I think when I watch like the Jason Bourne films, mm-hmm. or something like Mission Impossible Fallout, which also ends with like a mountain climbing kind of sequence, you do still see the rippling effect of North by Northwest, even like 60 years later. But yeah, do you perceive that too or not?
I think you do. And I think it's important to remember that this film came out before the first James Bond movie ever came out.
Yeah.
I think the novels were probably out, but we didn't have a visual representation of this. I think it's also very influential because on television, you had a lot of shows that were spy based. I mean, you had The Man from U.N.C.L.E., obviously Mission Impossible that we talked about, I Spy, even very comedic things like Get Smart, that all play on some of the aspects that we see in North by Northwest, the comedic elements for sure, the danger elements as well. And of course, we had espionage movies before this. Hitchcock, as we mentioned, did espionage movies before this. But there was something about the way that North by Northwest was constructed. And we can go back to people saying that this was a lighter Hitchcock film. I think that lightness transcends and carries over into some of these other films and television shows that we talked about. And I can't help but think it had to have gone through the minds of the creators of some of those films and television shows.
And I probably should have asked you this at the outset, really. But so when did you first see North by Northwest? Can you remember? And like, how many times have you seen it and stuff like that? Because I know one of the things I tweeted about recently was I was trying to get my son to sit down to watch it with me. And he's 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was probably about 14 when I first saw North by Northwest. And I really liked it. But it's not really his thing. But so my philosophy is, if he's not interested, I'm not going to force him to watch it. Maybe one day he'll come around, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. What kind of role has North by Northwest played in your life? Has this been one you've seen time and time again, or what?
I think I've seen it about a dozen times. And for me, that's quite a bit. I talk to people a lot that say they've seen, you know, Citizen Kane 50 times, or I've never seen any movie that many times. But I would like to, but, you know, it's one of those decisions. Do you see one of your favorites again, or do you see something new? Always a struggle. But I remember in college, it was my first year of college, and my roommate brought in a color TV into the dorm, and we, for some reason, some foolish reason, the college decided we're gonna give everyone on campus a subscription to Showtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very excited, and even back then I was a big classic movies fan, and I went through and I saw there's no classic movies playing on this, and then I thought, oh, North by Northwest, there's a Hitchcock movie I've never seen. And so I'm watching it on this tiny 12-inch screen. But I was absolutely glued to it, and my roommate wasn't out, and you know, it was going to play again because it was on Showtime, and I said, you've got to watch this is amazing. And ever since then, I've been a huge fan, and every time I talk to someone that says, oh yes, I'm a Hitchcock fan, have you seen North by Northwest? No, I haven't seen it. And I will immediately say, you have to stop whatever you're doing right now and go see North by Northwest. It's just a wonderful film. And, you know, a lot of Hitchcock films you can watch over and over. But and I think you mentioned it, too. I never get tired of this. All the times I've seen it, I know every line that's going to come. I know every scene. But I'm just captivated each time.
Yep, same here. Completely agree. And, you know, Andy, it'd be remiss of me to let you go, as you know, as a librarian, without asking you for some Hitchcock reading recommendations. And, you know, I think we've alluded to a couple of books throughout this podcast. But yeah, people who want to, you know, go off and read about Hitchcock, what book would you direct them to, or which books would you direct them to?
Excellent question. And as you said, we've already discussed a few of those. The probably two of the most famous ones are the Hitchcock Truffaut book that we mentioned before, which is actually just a conversation between Alfred Hitchcock and Francois Truffaut. If you can get your hands on that, which is pretty easy to get, that's a tremendous book. There's also there are a lot of biographies of Alfred Hitchcock. Probably the most famous one is Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light by Patrick McGilligan. That was published in 2003. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge book, and it's considered by many to be the definitive Hitchcock biography. Also, we mentioned Robin Wood and Hitchcock's Films Revisited, which is an excellent work. Hitchcock is such an important figure that you can find films just dedicated, or books dedicated just to one film. Psycho has many books, Vertigo, Marnie, One of my favorite books is a book on Rear Window by John Belton.
Okay.
And that book has a chapter just on Grace Kelly's costumes in Rear Window and what each of them means thematically. That just blew my mind. And that's why I'm so obsessed by Hitchcock and wardrobe choices that he makes.
Yeah.
But there are so many Hitchcock books out there. Those are the ones that I would start with.
Yeah, and one that I like too. It doesn't apply to North by Northwest, though, because it doesn't quite go that far. But it's Hitchcock, the first 44 films by Claude Chabrol and Eric Rohmer. Have you come across that one?
I know about it, but I'm glad you mentioned it to remind me of it, because I have not read it, but I would like to. And there's a new, in fact, your friend and mine, Raquel Stetcher, sends out a list of upcoming film books, and there's a new Hitchcock book coming out. I can't remember the title, but it covers all of his books. It's published by Taschen, and I think it's one of those massive Taschen books that's you know, 600 or 700 pages. But I have to get it.
Yeah, those things are huge.
They are.
Taschen books, aren't they? All right, and these are great stuff. So before we wrap up for the day, so where can people find you online, and you know, what have you been writing about these days and stuff like that?
Oh, sure. You can always find me at my website, and that's andywolverton.com, where you'll find my blog Journeys in Darkness and Light. You can find me on Twitter at @awolverton, the number 77, and I'm on Letterboxd as Andy Wolverton.
Great stuff. Thanks, Andy. Before our next episode, listeners, you can find us in all the usual places online. So we're on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, search for Movie Palace on Facebook and Instagram, and you find us there too. But that's all for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. CARLSWENEY. Thank you.